Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hi, I'm a little less coffee. Hi, I'm Joel. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you for having me. I'm from Perry Hall Speakers Group, which is right near Baltimore, Maryland. Thanks for having me up. It's exciting to be here. It's been a couple years since I've been to this meeting, and it was a little smaller, but very similar energy last time I came up here. So it's great to see that. I guess what I will do is whatever I try to do every other time I'm asked to do the talking part of AA, which is basically just try to tell my own experience about, you know, what it's been like for me to have alcoholism and kind of suffer from that, and then to recover from alcoholism, or at least think I've done that. I could be wrong in a lot of ways on all those accounts, but I'll just try to let you know how I see it. A concept that I have stolen from my sponsor about 6 years ago, but it's been serving me really, really well. I'm one of these people that I kind of think today that my alcoholism is not a direct result of drinking too much. I don't think I was once a cucumber and then had too many drinks and then became a pickle. I thought that for a long time. But today I just don't know that really fits for me. You know, the things that I think of when I say I'm an alcoholic in myself, I remember having a long time before I ever found the drink. And I very, very clearly remember experiencing them for years after the last time I had a drink. I've been sober since June 6th of 1995. It's really not since the fall, September of 2004, that I had been through the 12 steps, sort of more directly out of the big book, at least the way that I understand them today, to be based on an experiential kind of approach to having a spiritual awakening that can cure, if not, you know, I say treat, if not cure on a sort of a daily basis, the root cause and the root sort of reasons of why I drank and why I did a lot of things that I've done with really uncomfortable, awkward, ugly, expensive, painful results. That sort of has opened up for me an approach to life that has been a lot of fun. Fairly a lot easier, a lot simpler, a lot more comfortable than any other way that I've lived my life. Basically what I think that it means, you know, when I say I'm an alcoholic, it basically kind of comes down to two sort of things. You know, one, I am extremely obsessive and compulsive. You know, when I find something that I like, I just get a hold of it and I will repeat it and I can be extremely compulsive. You know, I think, and the way I think about that is, you know, I will think about something and drive on something and obsess on something even beyond the point of how much I want to obsess over it. You know, I really think of myself as I'm the mouse that's addicted to whatever substance in the cage and just will rub his nose right off of his face, you know, hitting that button, you know, one more. And, you know, and I can do that with regard to all sorts of things. That, you know, nothing more than the drink, though. You know, like with a lot of things, there's, you know, I can act out in a lot of ways, but for me, nothing more than the drink. I've had experiences, you know, way before I even picked up a drink, of just having, you know, thoughts or ideas or something in my head and just can't make it stop. You know, when I was a kid, but I guess all of my life I just loved boats. You know, like as a kid, I didn't have, you know, parents didn't have enough money, I never like had a boat, you know, which I thought made my life really, really difficult. But I could get access to drawings of boats and pictures of boats, and I could maybe get to the beach and see a boat go by and think about how wonderful I would be and life would be if I could be on that boat. But I would just think about boats and dream about boats and draw boats and fantasize and, you know, night dream, daydream, morning dream, whatever. And I remember, you know, thinking about that so much that I just wanting it to stop, you know, wanting to focus on something else or go to sleep or whatever else, and just not being able to get that grinding thought of like, oh, life would be perfect if I was just on a boat. And actually physically hitting myself to try to make myself stop that noise in my head of just, you know, just like stopping, you know, hitting myself in the head, or even actually sick or worse sort of, you know, infliction of pain on myself to just make that stop. The other thing that I think kind of makes up alcoholism in me is, you know, what our book and what my sponsor call the spiritual malady. And to take away the God, you know, sort of spin or lingo on it, which for so long in my life just made me not listen to anything that you had to say after spitting out some of that lingo. You know, the way I think about what that feeling is it's just a very deep sort of fundamental uncomfortableness with myself. You know, just deep down thinking, believing, feeling that there is something wrong with me, something that should be hidden, that should be protected, that should be lied about. And really, I think it's something that I felt, again, a long time before I picked up a drink, and it raged in me while I was drinking, but sober, and then raged again when I was sober, and not had a spiritual awakening, wasn't practicing something in my daily life to try to stay, in touch with that awareness. You know, that empty, disconnected sort of feeling is something that I carried around with me for the great majority of my life. And sometimes it would show itself as anger, sometimes as frustration, sometimes loneliness. But just, you know, almost all the time it was there. And from a very young age, I had an experience or an approach on life, which is, you know, I would feel that way about myself. I would feel as if there was me and something, you know, it's like I had a chocolate core and you guys all had a vanilla core and I needed to hide that. You know, I needed to pretend that I had the vanilla core like you guys. And, you know, it's like there's all of you, and then there was some kind of invisible line or force field or differentness or something. And then there was me. And you guys didn't look or sound like you felt the way that I felt. I had, you know, many, many, many nights of just having a horrible time falling asleep. You know, I've, you know, filled days. It's long been a habit of mine to be really, really busy, really, really active. You know, as a kid, I liked anything that was kind of a distraction or I could get a rise. I loved fireworks. I love BB guns and slingshots and rock fights and building a bomb and throwing fireworks at friends and cars and eggs and rocks at friends and cars and windows and vandalizing things and breaking into things and trying to run around, kill little animals or chase dogs or cats or kick over trash cans or steal things. Just whatever it was as a kid, I was very into the outdoors. A lot of the stuff I did as a kid, today you hear about kids, it's like you read in the newspaper about that sort of stuff. You kind of get away with more, I think. Not that I'm that old, but anyway. Basically I walked around feeling that way, as a little kid, you know, not all the time, not every second of every moment of every day that I feel that way, but a whole lot of the time. And what I did was, this is a theme or just a way of living my life that I sort of practiced for a long time, which is, you know, I would think that there really was something wrong with me and something different about me. And then I would look at your outsides and I'd look at my outsides and I'd try to find differences, you know, things to point at and to blame it on. And, you know, think to myself, well, if I had the things that you had, you know, then I wouldn't feel this way. If I could perform the way that you can perform, if I had the friends that you had, if I had the parents you had, and blah, 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 blah. And that thinking distorted my worldview drastically. You know, today I look at my sort of experience in life at a really high level, and I can see that I was born into this world from two parents who have loved me with their words, with their actions, with their thoughts, with everything that they could do for every minute of my life. You know, my parents, you know, came from both from very large families with all sorts of problems and, you know, things we could describe as abuses. And, you know, they fell in love with each other at a really young age and decided they wanted to have a family and that they wanted to provide for that family, as well as they possibly could and give their children the opportunities that they didn't have for education, for safety and love and respect and dignity and all sorts of things. And all of my life, every decision they made, was based on what was good for the kids. And today I look back at that and I can love them and I'm as close to my parents as I am to anybody in the world. And I love them for that. And I can see all that as clear as day. But for the great majority of my life, all I could see was I didn't have the right stuff. You know, we were, you know, living, you know, my parents made, you know, sort of low paying jobs, you know, stretch things, which kind of meant that we would always have that light brown house that's like just on the inside of the good school district. So you kind of go to school with all the other kids that have more stuff and, you know, prettier families and the right shoes and all sorts of stuff like that. And for a long time, I really thought that if I could just have that outside stuff, you know, I could talk for an hour about the pursuit of outside stuff, but, you know, drunk and sober, I sought that stuff for a long time, you know, thinking that it would make me okay, and it didn't, you know. And, you know, eventually, oh my God, I am on my way to a two-hour talk, so. I started drinking. I did start drinking. I was about 11 years old, you know, that, you know, as a kid, kind of the way I sort of described and found the drink. It was one of these classic AA kind of experiences. Somebody stole a little bit of this from the cabinet. Somebody stole a little of that from the cabinet. You know, we met in a little stream from a like storm drain kind of thing. And, you know, it was me and, you know, a handful of other kids. And I just absolutely freaking loved it. You know, from the beginning, it just fit with me. It was fun. It was exciting. I wasn't supposed to do it. It was, you know, I got a great big charge and rise out of it. It was awesome, cool, euphoric, high feeling that I love, from the very first. And, you know, what happened for me, and just to cut right to it is, yeah, it was really fun and really exciting for a little while. You know, right away, I'm like, I want this. I want this again. I want this more. I want to try little different ways of getting there with this. I want to do it with different people in different times, different locations. It was fun and it was exciting. And a lot of people in AA share, you know, like how they discovered very early on that it did something for them that it wasn't doing for those around them. But I think as I've thought about that, it's very true that it did something for me, but it's also true that in my case that it was doing that for all the guys that I discovered it with. Yeah, I think we have I certainly have a way of seeking out people that are like me, and that goes, you know, it's as true today as it ever was, and it certainly was true then. You know, all of those guys or those kids that I sort of discovered this thing with are, you know, seem to have this problem, because probably a third of them are dead, and a third of them are in here, and the other third, I, you know, for the most part, I keep tabs of what prison they're living in, or kind of what horrible sort of circumstance they're in. But in any event, the drink, you know, and just to be clear, when I say drink, you know, that encompasses, you know, any substance that I can ingest or smoke or swallow or drip into my eyeballs or whatever that gives me a feeling that is different than the feeling that I'm left with sober. You know, I think that's important that it's different, because it did not take long for me to get to a point where I just hated sobriety, you know, and I'll, you know, maybe jumping forward a little bit too fast, but the thing that the drink did for me that has become kind of cliche today, because I'm lucky enough to hear this all the time in meetings I go to and recordings I listen to and things like that is that the drink made me feel comfortable within myself. You know, that there's something wrong with me and I'm different than all of you and all that, all the mess that comes with and all the crazy, illogical structures that I think of and, you know, in life to sort of follow that just evaporated when I was drunk. you know, I just felt comfortable in the here and now in a way that I could not feel when I was sober. You know, that, you know, I had a brain that was coming at life from that uncomfortable perspective, and always thought that if something, then I'd feel comfortable. You know, if instead of here and now we were there and then, you know, whatever the blank may be, then I'd be comfortable. And when I was drunk, you know, that shut up. You know, I was not thinking about how much greater it would be to be across the street with some different people. It was like right here, right now with you guys doing this. All right. Yeah. Hey, it's Friday night. Look at this. Here we are. Three of us. Yeah. It's good times. It's guys, you know, whatever. It could be a girl here. It's all right. You know, maybe that happened a couple months ago. I can remember that fondly, you know, and, you know, sort of, I was just comfortable with me. And what I learned over the course of a couple of years, it didn't take that long, but I was well aware of it certainly within a couple of years, was that ease and comfort, that thing that it did for me, it did consistently. And it did it, without any regard for how I was doing or how I was performing in any other area of my life. You know, I could be an absolute failure with work, with academics. I could be a lie. I could be a cheat and a thief. I could be a horrible son, a horrible sister, horrible friend, cousin, you know, whatever it was. And the drink would work. You know, it didn't matter how I got it. Didn't matter if I stole it from you. Didn't matter if I, you know, what I did to get the money to get it. If I got the ingredients, it was like, you know, like a principle. You know, if I add me to the drink equals comfort, you know, and I could drink away, any sort of regret or any sort of sadness and loneliness and, you know, feeling sorry for myself. I could pass out and I could be comfortable. And, you know, what happened was, early on, I could drink every once in a while, and it would just be a really big, exciting, high, sort of fun experience. And then after a very short period of time, within probably a year or two, to be drunk was just like a baseline. You know, I would drink as often as I possibly could, while still being, you know, it's a very difficult goal. I mean, life was very, very difficult drinking for me, because the goal in drinking was to be drunk all of the time, which is very difficult because I needed to be able to pretend that I was sober enough that I wouldn't have awkward things happen where someone would catch me or lock me up or take things away from me or discover stuff, so which would keep me from getting drunk. So it's this trying to like ride this line of being drunk enough that I'm comfortable, but sober enough that I can pretend I'm sober. You know, and you add the limited resources and you add all sorts of things. This is a very, very challenging way for me to live my life. You know, and then you add on top of that the fact that over any significant period of time, I can't control my own drinking. You know, even when the goal, you know, I've never, ever, ever in my life, and this doesn't make me an alcoholic, it's just a fact for me, that I've never tried to drink in a way that's anything like what sort of is broadly seen as socially acceptable. You know, I've never had the goal of going to the bar and having two or three and going home. You know, every time I've ever consumed alcohol or anything else like that, my goal was to get drunk. But the thing that I would do, and to just use, you know, an example, you know, if I had a case of beer for a weekend, you know, I would say, all right, well, I have 12 beers tonight, and I have, you know, 12 for Friday, 12 for Saturday. I'm good. I'm drunk both nights. I'm comfortable. I'm more or less passed out. That'll get me through the weekend. And, almost every time, you know, it's Friday night. Feeling good, got that security of two nights worth of drink right here, and all ready to go. And I drink to 12, and I think I'm just a little more. You know, just a little thirsty. You know, 11 is still going to do the job tomorrow, but I can set 13, then it'll be 13-11, and that's fine. So I mean, deal. And then I add that, and it's like, well, I mean, 10 is, that's, 10's a good shot. You know, 10 will be good for tomorrow. You know, and you know the drill. It's, you know, the 18 into the first night, and then wake up the morning, it's like, ah, I am thirsty. You know, I mean, just, and then it's one, and then next thing you know, it's noon Saturday, and I'm freaking out and, you know, robbing somebody for the next night beer, you know? And all of that made for, you know, a lot of really uncomfortable stuff. Yeah. You know, I made, drinking, I made getting that feeling, that comfort, the top priority in my life consistently. You know, it was a priority above anything for myself. You know, it was far more important than my own health or my own finances. You know, I certainly would have spent and did spend all of my money. I spent all of your money. You know, I didn't care about, you know, hurting you with it. I didn't care about long-term goals with education or career or sports or dating or personal hygiene or fashion or, I mean, nothing, you know, nothing really mattered. I mean, really what, you know, sort of the end game for me with the drink was the last year and a half or so that I was actively drinking. I was living with my parents, had as close to no friends as I think you can get in this society. I mean, no one ever called. You know, all the friends that I'd had before, I'd lost because I would steal. You know, they would come over, and if I needed, I would steal from them. You know, they'd be hanging out, and somebody would go to the bathroom, and then come back, and, you know, they'd be like, wait, where is it? I'm like, what are you talking about? Where's what? You know, and 5 minutes later, you know, we're helping them look for it. You know, there's the other, it was Steve. I don't know why Steve left. You know, he had some, you know, it's just, you know, it got to the point, you know, at the end with certain relationships where I would just bold, outright mug friends. If they'd come over to the house, if I'd see them, I would just mug people. And you don't have to do that too many times before people just stop coming around entirely. So, which of course, it's probably one of, and you know, a lot of times in my life, I look back on that, I felt how horrible it was, but as sick and weird as it is to say, I'm pretty glad for the way things went, because I'm a poor mix of character traits and an alcoholic, and it led to a lot of, it's not a very perpetual lifestyle. You know, I'm the guy that you hang out with the friends, you're all sort of waiting for the stuff to arrive, and you send the guy on the moped out to get some stuff, and he comes back, and the second it's in my hand, I'm gone. I'm just gone. Like, I don't even say goodbye. I don't even just say, hey, the next time. It's just like, F it, I'm gone. I'm out of here. I got my stuff, you know, and then you'll hear from me when I'm like out, you know. So not very sustainable, which is lucky. So I, you know, found myself living with my parents, no friends, you know, no hopes of someday, you know, having a business or a career or an apartment, or a girlfriend or anything like being a productive member of society. You know, it was just, waking up on a daily basis with short-term goal in mind of to be drunk, you know, to be numb, to not feel the way that I felt on a daily basis. And I did, you know, basically anything that I thought I had to get that. I hated other people. You know, I felt like almost everybody I came into contact with was happier than me and had it better than me. I had bad luck. You know, I hated people, that were happier than me and had things I wanted, which was almost everybody else. You know, I was cold. You know, I would lie, cheat, steal from anybody that I came into contact with, usually guildlessly. And I had this terrible thing where I would see you having something that I wanted, you know, whether it's a physical thing or even a skill, and I would somehow feel challenged by that. And I would, you know, rather than, you know, today one of the 150 things that AA has taught me is like, if you see somebody that has what you want and they're living their life a certain way and consistently getting results that you're not or that I'm not, and I want to be like that, I can look at them and maybe mimic healthy behavior, you know, or ask them for help. And like, how do I also not be a douchebag? Like, how does that work? like, what does your day look like when you interact with people? How do you respond? You know what I mean? Like actually learn. But instead, for a lot of my life, I would see someone doing well, and my reaction is to just hate them. You know, and to want to, you know, I would live my life thinking it's a zero-sum game, that if, you know, the baseline is zero, if it's one up for you, if you look good in front of the boss, if you have a, you know, pretty girlfriend or dollar in your pocket, then somehow that makes me less by comparison. So I can either drag myself up, which I don't know how to do and I'm too lazy to do that, or I could try to drag you down, you know, or I'm too lazy to do that too effectively, so I'll just go key your car and call it a win, you know? That was sort of the way I lived. And, you know, and you know, that's slightly funny, but the reality was it really wasn't funny. You know, it was really just a sick, pathetic guy with a fiery hatred in his heart for everybody around him, and just, you know, fundamentally deeply uncomfortable with myself. And only knowing the short-term relief from the drink. You know, that was, you know, I think of all the things in the world that I'm aware of today that I think have value. You know, all the traveling I've done, the, you know, skiing and scuba diving, and, you know, there's beautiful places, and, you know, I'm going to go hiking in Colorado in a month or so, and go to San Francisco, and there's just all these beautiful places. There's nice people, there's relationships of all different kinds, there's family, there's, you know, just a nice drive on a normal spring day. There's good TV show. I mean, there's just, I could talk for an hour about all the nice, cool, fun, interesting things that go on in the world today that I get to experience. But for a couple of years of my life, I didn't care about any of that. None of it meant anything to me. The only thing that I really wanted was to be numb. You know, if there was a TV show on, that was great. You know, if everyone could get out of my face, that was even better. But I just wanted to be numb. You know what I mean? And I think the reason for that, which I could not articulate well at the time, was that sobriety just simply hurt. You know, being sober, being, you know, right here, just feeling all my fingers and all my toes and a clear head and the ability to remember what happened 5 minutes ago and the ability to feel my skin and all, in all sorts of places, just that, just being straight like that, just was just like a bunch of raw nerves. It was like being on fire. I hated it. You know, and I would rather be sick. I would rather be on any substance I could get my hands on. I would rather be on than feel that. You know, feel just that vivid, painful sobriety. I just hated it. And I ran from it. You know, like I was like running and screaming from sobriety. And you know, my grand sponsor says he was an answer drinker. You know, not a problem drinker. And that really hit me when I first heard that, and probably about 150 times afterwards, it hit me really hard too. You know, what was going on the outside is, you know, a lot of the sort of typical things that happen to us, which is, you know, I talked a little bit about horrible relationships and things like that. And you know, even those things, had happened to me long before I picked up a drink, but they were never more extreme as they were when I was drinking. And I was in, inpatient, outpatient rehabs, and would wake up in emergency rooms, and there was violence, and there was blood, and, you know, there was a lot of really embarrassing situations with the thievery and things like that. But given my experience in life up to that time, it kind of made sense, you know. I mean, being an alcoholic and looking back on that experience of sobriety being so painful and the relief from the drink being the only thing, you know, at that time in my life that I had discovered to make me consistently feel okay, it kind of makes sense, as sick as it is. But somehow something intervened in that pattern. I found myself in an emergency room following a 6-day, you know, mostly blacked out sort of period. And was sent, you know, against my will to a detox for about a week, and was struck with a feeling that I don't really understand. You know, for a long time I could sort of put that in some kind of context of, you know, the classic sort of made for TV after school special sort of thing of Johnny finds the drink and then everything gets bad and it's horrible and he's laid out in the room and there's the heavy music and the vodka bottle and it's just like this classic. Finds that it progresses, and then there's a bottom, and then like that bottom motivates me to like get on the treadmill and get some friends and get sober, and everything's great again because the drink's not there anymore. And I've got away, and I've leaned on some people to get away from the drink, but somehow I don't know that really fits, you know, with me, because, you know, there were ugly periods and there were bottoms and there were all sorts of things at many other times, but the last time I drank wasn't even necessarily the most ugly or difficult of any of those situations, but. I really think looking back at my own experience and looking at the other people whose recovery I've tried to be a part of in the last few years, where you see people, you know, in and out or struggling at different times, and you know, you're trying to help them, their parents are trying to help them, their friends are trying to help them, all sort of stuff, and you just kind of kind of realize, or I've realized, my own opinion is that it just kind of happens. You know, some force, something that I can't explain, got in there, I think, and changed my perception. You know, changed my approach to life. You know, at the very least, it was enough that I had this very, very strong feeling that my ideas weren't the answer. You know, and that it didn't last long, but I had a window where I knew deep down that, you know, my ideas were not serving me well at all, and my mind was very, very open to other things. And, you know, what happened was I got out and I went to, you know, 12-step meetings every day, put my hand out literally, you know, went up to the front of the room after the first meeting, that first day I got out, and I asked for help. You know, it was the guy in Brian's position, the secretary, who I figured was the leader of the group, who kind of knew what was up. And, you know, said, please help me. And, you know, what they did that night and every other time I've done that in AA or any other, it was actually a different fellowship that I first came to, was, there were people in the room that were willing to bend over backwards to give me what had been given to them. You know, they picked me up to meetings, they drove me places, they bought me coffee, they gave me friendship, they welcomed me into the group. They made me a member, they gave me a key to a church, they gave me a coffee commitment. They actually care, you know, and they made available everything that was available to them. And, you know, what happened for me was the approach to recovery that I found early on, was one where, like I kind of opened up with, where I thought that I had drank too much, and this was very consistent with the sort of a lot of professionals. You know, for a long time I'd had professionals, you know, people who for the most part, I'm sure, really cared about me. I had parents, teachers, police, you know, social workers, psychiatrists, psychologists, you know, staff at rehabs, all sorts of people, you know, telling me one version or another of the idea that I had drank too much and done a lot of other substances too much. And became dependent on them, and can't you see the horrible things you're doing in your life and doing to people's lives around you? And after a while of resisting that, because I didn't like the end result of that, which was stop drinking. You know, it's the only reason I ever resisted. I could always see it. And I was 13 years old and I absolutely knew that I was addicted to stuff and that my life was on the way to a toilet in no time. But the only reason I fought the idea was because somewhere along the way, if you accept that means you have to stop drinking, you know? And, you know, what happened was I got this idea in my head that the drink was the problem. And I was terrified of the drink. You know, just terrified. You know, because that feeling that I had in my life when I, you know, the last couple of years of wanting to control my drinking and not being able to and wanting to not cross certain lines, but finding myself, you know, in very short periods of time, crossing line after line after line, and that feeling just mentally, emotionally, spiritually, physically, like life is just slipping out of my hands, and just, you know, being so lonely and alone and having no friends, and, you know, everyone I pushed as far away as they would go or completely out of my life, and I had no one to talk to and relate to, and just feeling empty and alone, and just I hated that feeling, and just, you know, that one more, you know, just hated that. It's very, very uncomfortable. And, you know, and I had this idea in my mind that is kind of all of what it was to be an alcoholic. And what we could do in recovery is sort of link up with one another, to stay away from that. You know, I got phone numbers, I got a sponsor. You know, I got involved with the group in all the ways that you can. I traveled with them for 9 years, or at least 6 or 7 years anyway. Almost every one of my friends was in this program. You know, I stayed away from people that drank. I stayed away from bars. You know, early on I counted the days sober for hundreds of days. You know, basically, I just had this idea that if I stayed sober and then added sobriety plus time equals long-term recovery and good things. And I'll try not to talk about this sort of phase of my sobriety for like 20 minutes, as I sometimes do. But, you know, bottom line was, for me, that approach served me well in a lot of ways. You know, that the obsession for me went away. The obsession to drink went away. You know, I was able to learn some rational approaches to life from people around me. You know, that thing of just hating the guy that had the things that I wanted. I learned instead that you can befriend the guy that has the things you want and learn what he's doing and like get his help and then get the things, you know? And, you know, relationships with all sorts of people got better. I was able to be a friend. I was able to be a boyfriend and a brother and a son and a student and all sorts of, you know, really neat things happened. I went from being a high school dropout basically to community college to a 4-year college to a graduate program. And, you know, I got into lifting weights and, you know, that step happened there a little bit and then I lost a bunch of weight and, you know, I was able to trick a couple of girls into dating me, which was new. And that was a whole, that took a lot of work. It was a lot of effort from on a lot of people's parts for that. But eventually it happened a couple times and, you know, what happened was, you know, I describe all those things on the outside going well, and those are all nice things, and they really are gifts. In my experience, the gifts of recovery, gifts of sobriety, anyway, those things. But what was going on for me on the inside during that period, you know, beginning probably about a month or so sober, I started to get real sober. You know, I started to clear up mentally, and what that meant for me was that I was uncomfortable, that I would lie in bed many, if not most nights, feeling empty and disconnected and alone and lonely. And, you know, I'd shut my eyes and feel like I'm floating in space, like trying to grasp at the ship. Where's the ship? I want the ship. I don't feel any connection. You know, I'd had early on in recovery, I'd had really basic sort of understanding or philosophy or idea of God that I was able to sort of be comfortable with. But then I went to college and then I was too smart for God. And then I looked down on people that had any kind of a relationship with God. You know, I tried really, really hard to intellectually understand God. You know, for a long time I thought, you know, how can I turn my will and my life over to, you know, a higher power, to an understanding of God that, you know, that's my understanding if I don't understand it? You know, so for me, right out in front of all the steps was, what do I believe in? Where does it live? How does it work? What does it do? What does it not do? You know, all these sorts of intellectual, logical questions that I couldn't answer in any other way than there's no freaking God. You know, I just couldn't believe in it, you know? Here, of course, I'm going to talk about that for like 20 minutes. So what happened was when I was in that, you know, living that sort of thing, you know, going to whatever meetings were local, you know, not thinking or talking about recovery on the way to the meeting, you know, talking with people at the meeting, not about recovery in any other, you know, in any way or thinking about recovery, and then sort of sit there and, you know, hope I would never get called on, and I get called on and say, oh my God, I'm so grateful to be sober, so happy, it's just such a great thing, I love AA, love you guys, humble, 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 nothing, 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 happy to be here, and I'm going to keep coming back, you know. And what happened was there were a group of people that I identified with from this Harbor City speakers meeting that was near me, and they would a lot of times wear ties when they spoke. They would travel in groups. You know, they would laugh and tell stories about traveling long distances for AA, which didn't make any sense to me at all. You know, more than anything, they talked about God, you know, in a way that they talked about recovery, having recovered, you know, having a relationship with a higher power. You know, there were people with much less time sober than me that would stand up in front of a group and look people in the eye and look out in the audience and say, I'm 6 months sober. I've been through the steps. I've had a spiritual awakening. I've recovered from alcoholism. I feel great every day of my life. I can show you how it's available. I have a relationship with God, and that they would quote the book, and they would say, and all I could hear was just, oh, the arrogance, you know, the filthy pink cloud inspired arrogance of this. Oh God, he is going to crash and crumble, and I can't wait to watch it happen, you know. And I would be offended because sometimes they would do that and talk for too long, and then calling a friend of theirs I didn't even know. and then calling another friend of theirs that I didn't even know, and it's before I know it, the meeting's over, and none of my friends got to talk, and this was horrible. This is creating a rift in AA, and which it did. But and then what happened was, I found myself in a position of, a thing didn't work out with a lady friend the way that I wanted it to, and I found myself really, really unhappy. For about a month, it was one of these resentments where I wake up in the morning and just before my eyes even opened up, I was hating this person and hating three people around her and, just really unhappy. And I was somehow, against my will, sort of convinced to go down to this group and sort of see what was going on. And I went down there, and from the very first night, I saw something going on that was different and heard something. This was summertime in South Baltimore. They were in a room probably half the size of this with about the same number of people. It was August. There was no air conditioning. And there was a guy standing at the front of the room with a shirt and tie on, and he was from Portland, Maine. And he was talking for a whole hour. He was speaking clearly and talking about recovery and things that had happened to him and all this great stuff and all this stuff about God and recovery and perception and all these things. And I was sitting there and the whole meeting, I'm just thinking, it's Thursday night. We're in South Baltimore. He's from Portland. How does he get here? Like, is this group paying for him to come down here? He's talking about having a job. Is he missing work tomorrow? I did not understand what it meant to travel for AA or to care about AA enough that he would put on a suit and go to these great efforts. It did not fit into my understanding of what AA was. And, what happened was I went back to that group, for a few weeks and consistently heard a message that was interesting, that was consistent, and that I just did not understand at all. And I asked a guy to take me through the steps. With 9 years sober, I went through the steps in a way that was completely unlike anything that I'd experienced before. Every other time I'd been through the steps, it was the way I see it now, it's kind of like a glorified friendship. I would find somebody that I liked and that was sort of living a lifestyle that I wanted to live, and we would basically become friends. We'd go out, he'd tell me his story, I'd tell him my story, he'd tell me his ideas about things, and he would ask me about mine. What are your ideas of God and powerlessness? And why don't you write about that? And we can talk and bat ideas back and forth and talk about all sorts of things, and then we do a fourth step, and you can share your experiences, the things you did, and I'll share my experiences, and at the end it's, hey, it's all good, it's cool. One of us, and it would give me some relief because I felt like I was one of the group when I did that. I made some great friendships and had some kind of sort of mentor sort of relationships with guys, but nobody showed me the stuff that he showed me, or at least I never picked it up. I'm like a lot of people in our sponsorship family sort of try to make clear, like, I'm sure it was said somewhere, I just didn't pick it up. What he showed me was, he showed me a few things. I certainly won't try to walk through the steps in the next 12 minutes or so. But basically the way I see it today is that I was missing half of the first step. The idea that I am powerless over the drink, and that inability to control my consumption of alcohol, leads to a lot of problems in my life. I believe that's absolutely true today. If you're sitting here with 2 minutes sober, welcome. And, the drink is a problem, for me, everything that's come in recovery after that is relying, I believe, on staying away from the drink. Find a group of people, find whatever you need to do. I mean, get sober one day at a time, absolutely. But the thing for me is that if I can stay sober for a week or a month or 6 months or whatever it may be, whatever time it takes to actually get all that stuff out of my body. And at that point, with nothing else happening, there's still a raging problem in me. And that is the sort of the other part of the first step, which is that I'm powerless, kind of like with a capital P. That I'm fundamentally disconnected from a power. And the way I see that today is that, I believe that that I'm basically just sort of one of the group. You know, that I'm sort of a child of God, the way that you and all of us are sort of children of God. And, you know, we're all sort of created from the same thing. You know, that, you know, you may be smarter than me and faster than me, and, you know, but I may be able to draw a duck better than you or something like that. Like, you know, you have skills and I have skills and attributes. And for a long, long time, I thought that I was down here and you were up here, or I was down, you know, we're always off like this in all sorts of different ways. And I had to measure up and I had to outperform. I had to out-have. I had to out-be. I had to know things. I had to do things. I had to perform things to be okay. But what was passed on to me is that it's possible, regardless of how poorly I perform in any area of my life, or regardless of how, you know, how much my butt sticks out or my nose is too pointy or whatever it is, I can be okay. You know, I can wake up and be fundamentally okay with myself. You know, and my heart can be full. You know, and I can look at you and not feel that I'm infinitely less than you, or mask that feeling with this sort of bullshit belief that I'm better than you in some way, you know? that I can just be on an even keel with people. And that's something that I could not do without a bunch of drinks in me. And, you know, the idea that disconnect, that spiritual malady, whatever you want to sort of call it, is part of my problem. You know, whether, you know, even with 9 years sober, that I have that powerlessness and that there's a treatment for it. You know, the next sort of phase was this idea of a relationship with God, being able to treat that. And that idea is something that was extremely, extremely difficult for me for a long time. And, you know, the way I see it today, the way I sort of understand God, is that I realize I have to sort of try to have the humility to realize that I don't think I can understand God. That I'm probably not made to be able to understand and know and perceive God in all the ways that God is. You know, the way I think about it is it's like fish. And I've stolen this story. I actually heard it like 15 years ago and then re-remembered it about 6 years ago, and I've been talking about it for the last three. But I once heard a guy put it this way, which is, you know, think about fish, like salmon or tuna, or particularly fish that swim around in the ocean in schools, and they tend to have light colored bellies and dark colored backs. You know, they swim around and that color sort of scheme protects them because predators, things that are looking up at them from underwater, they see the light belly against the light sun of, light of the sun, and the fish is hidden, the fish is protected. You know, birds or whatever swimming or flying above the fish, they look down and they see the dark backs of the fish against the dark, you know, depths of the ocean. And again, the fish is hidden, the fish is protected. And I could be wrong, it could be wildly wrong, but I don't think the fish have any idea this is happening. And I don't think a salmon has the brain power to look and say, like, I'm like that fish and this fish, and he has the light belly and the light and the sun, dark in the back, and me and my back. Like, I don't think they can put all that together at all. You know, it's when shown, I'm able to see it, but I don't think any salmon that ever existed in the face of the earth has ever been able to understand that. They're just not made to, you know? And why can't it be that just because I think I'm smarter than a salmon, that there aren't things like that happening in my life all of the time that I'm not able to perceive? You know, even within the realm of things that I can perceive, I am capable of having vast fundamental delusions about my own experience. You know, even things that are right in front of my face all my life, I am capable of overlooking them and completely misunderstanding them. You know, and it could be that, you know, just because I think, you know, I'm smart, I'm a human being, and I went to Towson University, so hey, big brain in the room, you know. Like, you know, just because of that, why can't there be all sorts of things out there happening and going on that I'm not able to perceive? And somewhere in that the humility that comes along with that is the idea that there's something out there that I can't see, that I can't prove, that I can't intellectually know. So I have faith, you know, and somewhere in there is sort of that sort of door cracking open with that little, like, okay. You know, that was just enough to keep moving and to sort of have this thing work. And, you know, one more step-based thing that I want to talk about is pretty much the way I see it, just about everything else sort of operates off of this idea, which is in the third step, this idea that self and self-focus is the root of my problem. You know, for a long time in my life, I thought that self-focus was the answer. I thought recovery was selfish. I thought everything in life was selfish. Every problem I had was the answer was just was just better thinking about me. You know, if I'm lonely, then I need a girlfriend to fix that. And if I get a girlfriend and she doesn't fix it, well, it's because I didn't find the right attributes in a woman. I need to get out a piece of paper and a pen and then, well, she was this, so I want that. She was this, so I want that. I need someone who's, you know, I'm feeling lonely, so I need someone who's here for this. And, you know, like, just, I just needed to think and focus inwardly and figure out what material stuff in the world I need to make me feel comfortable. And that is how I ran my recovery. That's how I ran every aspect of my life. Me focused. Sober, drunk, my whole life was entirely me focused and had no idea that that was a problem. No idea that just the better me thoughts wouldn't fix me. And, you know, what I found in the third step is this idea of self-centered fear. You know, that me thinking about me driven by some kind of fearful motive seems to be at the root of everything that bothers me. And as an answer for that, you know, I was presented with this concept of a relationship with a higher power that is not selfish. You know, for me in the past, even my relationship or concept of God was completely selfish. It was, I'm here and I want to be there and God's going to somehow line things so I can get there. You know, and even with sobriety, you know, it's like, I want to be sober so I can be happy, so I can get a car, so I can get a girlfriend. Because I get my shit together, I'm going to get sober and be happy, you know. God, keep me sober. You know, at the end of the day, God, thank you so much for keeping me sober. Please do that again tomorrow. Help me sleep for this. You know, get some rest for this test, and if you could align this and put that here, I'd really appreciate it. Thank you so much. You know, even that for me was selfish, and it just doesn't work. You know, I had no idea that the third step prayer right there it talks about not being selfish. You know, that we're asking God into our life to relieve us of this alcoholic suffering, so that we can be an example to others of what God can do. You know, so that we can go out and better do God's work in the world by helping people. You know, and what was shown to me in AA, you know, very importantly shown and then also explained, was a concept of AA that's based on having the spiritual awakening, where we then seek to serve God by helping other people. And that construct beat into me again and again and again by watching people, you know, people like the people that come down to our group from this group, like the people that helped to start this group, people like the, you know, the sponsor I have and hundreds and I'm sure thousands and thousands of other people in AA that are doing this thing, that are constantly thinking of new and better and effective and creative ways to present this message to other people. You know, using our brain power to think, you know, how can I be kind to this person? How can I make this message clear to this person in a humble, you know, in a humble, kind and loving way? You know, how can I approach my family in a way that's kind and loving? How can I look out for them? How can I go to work and try to make my coworkers' jobs easier for them today? You know, how, and taking that approach into every area of my life has completely changed my experience. You know, I have just a couple more minutes and I think the important things to say is that, you know, sobriety and kind of rational living for me got me a lot of really neat physical things. But doing these steps and having a spiritual awakening and then trying my best to pass this on to other people, which is another topic I'd love to talk about for 25 minutes. So you're luckily not going to get to hear that. you know, but you know, that is absolutely key. You know, once I went through these steps, it only got stale. I then had to reach out and pass it on to other people to keep it alive and fresh and active and interesting. And, you know, and then those people help wedge into my life in every way that they can possibly think of, I can possibly think of. And the result is just fantastic. You know, probably the best thing that's happened to me in the last 5 or 6 years is, you know, a lot of things on the outside have gone very well in the last, you know, handful of years. You know, when I came in here and, you know, looked around at all the people in life that had things that made me hate them, the material stuff, you know, today that stuff is all around me all the time. You know, I have a job that's rewarding in a lot of ways. You know, I have a lot of relationships that are really rewarding. I have really loving, great relationship with my parents. You know, I have, on the outside, I would absolutely love to key my car. You know, 15 years ago, I would just want to just grind all over the door of my car, just hating me. I would have hated me for the outside things, you know, and you know, to watch me walk across the parking lot smiling. But, what is even a more interesting and better gift than that is to have some of those things and realize that they do not make me happy. You know, I had to fight and sacrifice and cut corners and just stay up all night long again and again and again and again to get worldly things, to have them, and then realize that, whatever, it does not make me happy. You know, I can be every bit as happy or more happy driving an 88 Dodge Colt than I can driving, you know, whatever other cars I've had since then. You know, those material things do not make me happy. And what's even better than that is having the things that do, which is this spiritual awareness and this spiritual recovery, and, you know, being a part of you know, of our home group and of AA and the sponsorship family and traveling and experiencing all these things and living a full, happy, comfortable life and sleeping at night, you know, and waking up on a daily basis being comfortable to be me and to not hate the people that are around me. You know, in this last year, I've had a couple of experiences that have really sort of exemplified recovery for me, which is, you know, and I'll just talk about one of them for about 1 second, which is, you know, the person over the last 14, 15 years of my life that's been the closest to me, my friend John, guy I met in here and who's since had a lot of struggles, but nonetheless, we remain really, really tight friends. He died of an overdose. And it was, you know, as I don't know that there's ever an overdose death that's not awkward and uncomfortable and painful for all sorts of people, but this one very, very, very much was. And it's one of those experiences that challenges my ability to not see things in black and white or in good as good and bad. Because in that situation that I could easily characterize as bad, you know, there was actually a lot of good. You know, there are a lot of opportunities to be of service to his family. You know, there were a lot of opportunities to be of service to his friends and sort of, you know, that he was given, you know, the ability to talk at his funeral and be a part of planning things and be a part of the estate and parts of all sorts of stuff. And there were a lot of people that did not have the gifts that AA gave me that made doing those things for me fairly straightforward. You know, for most of my life, I would never have been able to see that situation as an opportunity as much as anything else. And, you know, that change of perception is a huge part of what AA has given me. I'm talking too long. Thank you guys for having me.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.